market,
the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that thinks bonds are a financial instrument and not a pair of undies. I'm Andrew Page, and with me is Scott Phillips.
G'day, Andrew. G'day, fools.
It's been a big week for the movers and shakers, so let's dive straight into it. We're going to put our finger on the pulse of the Aussie economy. Have a little bit of a look into our crystal ball, have a look at some job numbers and where interest rates might be headed. We also check in on the pizza wars. Can the latest move from Pizza Hut stop the relentless march of Domino's? We also try to make sense of Warren Buffett's move into airlines, something he'd long said he was a very bad idea. So we're going to try and unwrap that riddle. And finally, we open the foolish mailbag and answer a listener's question on bonds and derivatives. But first, Scott, state of the economy, the state of play, hit me.
Well, a bit of good and a bit of bad, Andrew. Well, okay. It depends actually who you are and what you want. So the good news was there were 41,000 new full-time jobs added to the economy in October.
Hooray.
Undoubtedly good news. Another in the long line of effectively economic improvements. The jobs numbers have been something of a highlight when growth hasn't been great. It's been okay. Wage rises certainly haven't come through. Mm-hmm. But the number of jobs being added to the economy is an absolute undisputed positive. 41,000. And the unemployment rate stayed steady at 5.6%. Mm. Again, a very, very low number. Could it be lower? Of course it could. It's been a whole lot higher in the past. So overall, a really good set of numbers on the jobs front.
Okay. Got to be happy with that.
Indeed.
So meanwhile, out there, what we've really seen in the wake of the US election here is that the market seems to have changed its mind on where interest
many,
rates
many,
have
many times
headed.
The market has changed its mind the last two
as
weeks.
As is its wont.
Exactly.
And you know, fairly significantly too. Mm. So, you know, it's all coming from the Trump win, of course. He's talking about tax cuts. He's talking about big infrastructure spending. So that's then led on to this expectation that rates in the US will rise. And it's also trickled over here as well. So I guess the first, and you know, a lot of listeners out there will have home loans, and yes, you know, you don't want to spook everyone by saying interest rates are heading up, but that's what the markets are saying.
But exactly.
What do we make of this?
All right, let's try and pick it apart without going too much into the weeds. And if I do, Andrew, throw something at me and I'll stop.
All right.
Basically, what's happened is the Donald Trump presidency was originally this horrible thing to fear, as we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. Then it was the greatest thing ever. Mm-hmm. And that kind of broad theme has continued on. The original thought was the US Federal Reserve, our version of the RBA, would probably sit on its hands in the face of a Trump presidency because it was such an unknown quantity.
Yep.
Very quickly, though, because the markets have taken to it, frankly, pretty well, because there's so a fun sense that maybe Trump might actually be good for the economy in the short and medium term, there's so much stimulus, as you've already mentioned, possibly going to the US economy, the US Fed kind of has cover now to increase rates. Mm-hmm. Now, remembering US rates are at a quarter of a percent. Yeah. These are super, super low rates.
Yeah.
The reality is, neutral in the US, neutral here is about 3.5%, 4%, generally speaking. Yep. Neutral in the US has been 2 or 2.5%. Mm-hmm. We are miles below that number right now. So Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, our version of the RBA governor, she's pretty much got a mandate to get rates back to a more neutral setting when the economy can bear it. The Donald Trump presidency, pretty much in most people's minds right now, is that, look, this is going to be very, very stimulatory for the economy if he carries on with most of what he's planning. Much more stimulatory in the short to medium term than a Clinton presidency would have been. Mm. So the US Fed's looking at that and going, which is, if there's going to be this much money piled into the economy, we'd better start moving rates sooner rather than later. Or at least that's what the market is guessing. No one knows, of course. We won't know until the Fed meets in December. But right now, that's the assumption. Mm. Now, that means US rates are going to go up.
Mm.
That puts the economy in a better position. And frankly, it also gives the RBA cover, if that happens, to also increase rates. So
well,
you think about the difference.
That's the trouble that I have trouble drawing a line between those two.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it is an interconnected world.
Yep.
They're a big trading partner of ours, you know, but they're there and we're here.
Yes.
How does that, those factors that you talked about impact us here in Australia?
The little Aussie battler, Andrew. The Australian dollar.
The Aussie dollar.
The Aussie dollar. So what happens basically, the dollar is set based on a whole lot of different factors. No one ever really knows. There's no official formula, but a combination of difference in interest rates, difference in economic growth are the two primary mm-hmm. changes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our economic growth is pretty good. US is also pretty good. Over time, though, our dollar is sitting about 75 US cents at the time of taping, a little bit lower, I think, overnight. Basically, the lower that dollar goes, the better our industry is set to compete on the international stage versus the rest of the world. Now, if the RBA puts rates up, that makes our dollar more attractive because other people from overseas want to invest in Australian stocks, bonds, shares, term deposits, everything else, because they're going to get a higher return. So they buy more Australian dollars and the Aussie dollar goes up. Glenn Stevens hasn't wanted that. The new RBA governor, Philip Lowe, doesn't want that. So that's part of the reason they've had to keep rates low. Once the US goes up, and if the Australian growth numbers are good, the RBA basically has cover to also increase, without causing an unnecessary impact on the dollar. That's all very economic finance speak for basically it's a race. And you want to position yourself to win that race. In the RBA's case, lower is better when it comes to interest rates. But if it's too low for too long, they're going to create bubbles in the Australian economy.
And I guess you don't have any powder dry for when you perhaps really need it.
Exactly. So they want to keep rates as high. Well, they want to keep rates as neutral as they can as well. Rates are designed, they drop them to stimulate the economy. They increase them to pull the economy back, but only from that neutral rate. Now, neutral, I said before, 3.5%, 4%, it's going to be lower in future for a whole lot of reasons we won't bother going into right now, but we can at a different stage. But over time, the financial markets, all of a sudden, for the first time in many, many years, I want to say 5 or 6 years, it may not have been quite that long, but probably is, are now pricing in the next move in Australian rates being up. Mm. Previously, it had been down. Now, the average expectation is that rates are going to rise. Not necessarily straight away, not necessarily even this year, but probably sometime next year, the betting of the financial markets, and they've been wrong before, is that rates will go up rather than down. That means effectively we're at the bottom of the rate cycle. And if you're taking on a mortgage, if you're borrowing money, if you've got a credit card or anything else, expect that your costs of borrowing, your interest rate you're paying, will be higher 12 months from now than it is today.
Mm. And frankly, that was always a good assumption before this anyway, right? Yeah. If you were taking out a 30-year mortgage, chances are interest rates are probably going to go up at some point over that period.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got a tightening bias, to use the lingo.
Oh, yeah, if you have
to. Do you like that?
No.
Okay, let's move on.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Pizza Wars.
Hey, there we go.
Are you a Domino's
from the sublime to the ridiculous? From the ridiculous to the sublime.
Are you a Pizza Hut man or a Domino's man?
Yeah, I was always a Pizza Hut man, but I've been swayed to the box with the dots, and I'm definitely a Domino's fan these days.
Man, hasn't that landscape changed? I remember as a kid, you'd go along to Pizza Hut, you'd have the dessert bar. You know, it was just awesome. It was so exciting when Mum and Dad said they were taking you to Pizza Hut.
Absolutely.
And it's just, the landscape has changed so dramatically since then. For starters, you don't really go and eat at a Pizza Hut anymore. No. In fact, it's much harder to find a Pizza Hut these days. But let's go back to the beginning.
And we've tried.
So Pizza Hut has really been on the wane. It's really, really been struggling. Yep. And there's a third player out there as well called Eagle Boys. And they've been doing it even tougher. They own less than 10% of the $3.7 billion pizza market. That's a B. That's hell of a lot of,
that's a lot of pizzas,
you know, stuffed crust pizzas. And so in their effort to sort of, you know, fight back, Pizza Hut has acquired Eagle Boys. Mm. So Pizza Hut's got about 270 stores. They're going to take 114 odd Eagle Boys. They're going to merge together and they're going to take on Domino's. Now, Domino's sits at the top of the pile. They own half of the market, 600 odd stores. Is it going to be enough to reverse their fortunes?
No,
I don't think so.
Domino's is the unstoppable force, quite frankly.
Right.
But, you know, you're right. So much has changed in the 80 or 90 years since we were kids, Andrew. The reality is that, you know, the market has changed dramatically, and Domino's has taken a lead and has spent most of the last decade extending that lead really, really dramatically now.
Massively.
Once upon a time, for those Sydney listeners, the old 4811111, do you remember those?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I can still hear that
theme,
in my head.
Wasn't it?
Exactly. Like, yeah. I won't do it. I'll save our listeners the oral torture. Reality is that, yeah, that was massive. It was huge. It was going nuts. It was all about Pizza Hut. And Domino's was a little one off to the side. The pizzas weren't great. Right.
No.
All of a sudden, along comes Don May, the CEO of Domino's, and has done a spectacular job. They've improved the pizzas. They've lowered the cost just time after time after time after time.
Yeah.
Fantastic marketing, social media marketing. Yeah. They've really revolutionized the entire industry.
Better systems, logistics, all the rest
of it. Yeah, and I say revolutionized. It's one of those throwaway lines. But, you know, we did the numbers before the show. Domino's share price has gone up by 40% per year on average over the last 10 years. That's the best part of a 30x turnaround. That's a $10,000 turning into $300,000 over a decade, which is a spectacular result and just underpins how well Domino's have done this thing.
Right.
The challenge now is that, you know, the food business, you don't think of the food business as a scale business, as a business that necessarily benefits from scale, right? A pizza's a pizza. It's got some flour, some water. You figure the cost should be roughly the same. The differences, though, in market share are so dramatic right now. The trajectories of growth are so dramatic. Domino's is benefiting from much, much, much better economies of scale. They got lower prices, lower costs per unit made, per pizza made, effectively.
Well, you can to use the lingo, you can fractionalize your costs over a much larger base.
Fractionalize your costs. Let's just write that one down.
Well, you know, you've got a marketing, everyone's got a marketing spend, Pizza Hut's advertising, right. Domino's advertising, but when Domino's advertises, it's doing so on behalf of 600 stores as opposed to the much smaller count that Pizza Hut has.
Correct. So you buy one 30-second ad on Channel 9, and it's going to cost you the same amount with your Pizza Hut or Domino's,
yep.
But Domino's are going to generate a whole lot more revenue and profit from that 30-second ad, which means they can afford to spend more, they can afford to do more of them than Pizza Hut.
And that theme plays out over a whole bunch of costs, whether it be corporate head office costs, whether it be your purchasing power. You can buy dough at a much better bargain when you're buying much more of it.
And I've got one word for you.
What's that?
Drones.
Drones.
Domino's in New Zealand have successfully done the first pizza delivery using a drone. That's so about cool. All we need to know, I think. If you think about the pizza, who's going to win the pizza wars? The company with the drone. It's an absolute slam dunk.
Well, don't they have a robot pizza delivery in the Gold Coast as well?
Oh, probably. They've got electric bikes. This is just, yeah. You know, look, a drone's not a big deal. They're nice for headlines, right? But this is, you know, it's a sideline, let's be honest. But it's all about what Domino's are doing differently, better, changing healthier menus, chef's best pizzas, social media marketing campaigns, electric bikes, you know.
Just the app, the app interface and the you know, exactly. that client user experience is just incredible.
You can actually pay now $3 an order
yep.
for guaranteed delivery within 20 minutes using the app, which is pretty cool.
Awesome. Right. So Pizza Hut's back to the wall here. It's painted into a corner. It's got to get scale. It makes sense, but we just don't think it's going to be enough.
I don't think it's going to be able to maintain a slice of the pizza market, Andrew.
Before we it's a very crusty joke. Before we move on.
Can you top that?
Let's just end it at this point.
Too cheesy? Okay.
Yeah, very cheesy.
All right.
So Domino's a listed company, as you mentioned. Yes. It's gone up incredibly. Is it worth buying today?
The crust has risen. Look, Domino's is incredibly expensive, I have to say. Yeah.
But it's been expensive for... I mean, you could have said that 3 years ago. You could have said that last year, and you would have still gone really well.
I did say that 3 years ago. I sold my Domino's shares at about $13.
I just wanted to remind you.
I doubled my money, Andrew. I went from 6 to 13. I said, you're great. So smart. Yes. I've made a fortune. Now the shares are $60.
Oh.
A lot of pizzas.
But is it too late? That was then, this is now. You can always buy some more.
Here's the problem. You can, that's exactly right. And we shouldn't anchor to past decisions. I'm probably making the same mistake, quite frankly. Domino's is much bigger, better. It now owns Domino's Japan. It's got a massive operation in Australia. It owns a nascent, I think we can say, pizza business in Europe. Mm-hmm. I would never, ever, ever bet against Domino's and Domino's management.
Yep.
But I'm not just prepared to buy the shares at the moment. They're trading at such a ritzy multiple that not much needs to go wrong for... really things to get bad share price wise. So maybe I'm missing out on more gains, and we'll do this in 2 years' time and you'll say, but Domino's $120 a share now. Scott, how'd you go with that? I reckon they're a little bit too expensive to buy in the $60, $70 range. I'd love to own the company again. One of the very best management teams in the country, not just in food, right across the ASX.
Yeah.
One of the unsung heroes, Don May, and the management team there. High quality business, wonderful business. Mm. Unfortunately, just a little bit too rich for my blood.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there, mate.
Bit too spicy.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's go from pizzas to airlines.
How's that for a segue, fans?
That's a pretty bad one, but here we go. So we're going to talk Warren Buffett, world's greatest investors.
Now I'm interested.
He's the guy that we have. I've got a big Buffett poster on my wall. That's how much of a nerd I am.
He's not kidding.
I really do.
He really does.
He's just an awesome investor, and he's got all these lovely, you know, quotes and the rest of it. And you know, one of the things he said for a long time is that buying an airline, it's a death trap. A death trap for investors. He also jokes that he's got a 1-800 number he can call. So, you know, if ever he's tempted to do it, you know, there's someone who can sort of talk him back from the ledge. But here's the thing. Recently, he's not just bought one, two, or three. He's bought four airlines.
Well, to be clear, shares in four airlines.
Sorry, I should say. He's bought some shares in four airlines.
Indeed.
Delta, American Airlines, United, and Southwest. What the hell? WTF.
You know what? That's pretty much right. This is the... I still can't get... Well, the first thing we should say is that Buffett himself probably didn't buy these shares. So Warren Buffett's got two investment managers who work for him, who've been working for him now for about half a decade. I want to say 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
The sizes of these stakes, massive though they are smaller than Buffett's normally. Buffett's with the really, really big buys, the billion-dollar-plus kind of deals.
Yep.
His two investment managers, Ted and Todd, you've mentioned, Andrew, Ted Weschler and Todd Combs, they're the guys who make these sort of the hundreds of million dollars, just the small decisions, right? The ones only that go to 9 or 10 figures. So that, you know, he probably hasn't made the decision himself. That being said...
He would have had to sign off on it.
No, he doesn't. That's it. He doesn't. He lets them do exactly what they want to do.
Whatever, okay.
But Ted and Todd are also... These guys, they're value investors anyway. They're in the Buffett mold. That's why he chose them. Mm. So while Warren Buffett himself isn't putting the big WB stamp on this thing, he's pretty much saying, look, these guys I handpicked, I've thought airlines are a good deal, and so we should be paying attention.
Let them have their head.
Okay. Now, they haven't said why they've bought airlines. Mm. And it's a really tough situation to try and work out what they're seeing in these airlines.
Well, can we take a step back?
Sure.
And before we talk about why they may have done it, why has Buffett in the past said why you shouldn't do it? I mean, I know we've touched on this before in a past podcast.
We did.
And we're no great fans of the air. We talked about a Qantas.
We are on record.
On record. And it's not for silly reasons, we don't think. They're extraordinarily capital-intensive businesses. They're essentially selling a commodity, which is an airline seat. You want to go from here to Melbourne. You know, it's not a huge... People will talk about differences, but there's not a massive difference between whether you go for Virgin or Qantas. So you have these capacity issues. You're at the whim of the cycles in the economy and also fuel prices and the unions, and it's just super, super, super tough. And more than anything, you're often dealing with very irrational competition who's all trying to win market share, and by trying to do that, lowering prices and hurting themselves and everyone. So that hasn't changed, has it?
Let me give you this quote from Warren Buffett to exactly kind of cover the very thing you said. Let me quote him. The worst sort of business is one that grows rapidly, requires significant capital, in other words, more cash, to engender the growth, and then earns little or no money. Think airlines. Here are durable competitive advantages proven elusive ever since the days of the Wright brothers. Indeed, if a far-sighted capitalist had been president at Kitty Hawk, where the first Wright brothers flight took place, he would have done his successors a huge favor by shooting Orville down. That's pretty clear, right?
Yeah.
And Buffett has said, as you've already mentioned, he bought and then sold them and said, oh, thank God I got out without losing too much money. That was a stupid decision. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
Fast forward to 2016, he owns shares in four airlines.
Yeah,
we can't know. He hasn't said why.
Okay,
I'm pretty sure you and I are still on the no side of the equation.
Yep.
If you were to try and speculate, it goes something like this: that we've said often, and this is if you want to write something down, Fools, as part of this podcast, write this down. You can only be as profitable as your least rational competitor allows you to be. Think airlines, think oil, think coal, think anything. You've got massive amounts of competition. If your competitor drives the price down, even if they're losing money, you have no choice but to match them or lose business. You kind of don't have, there's no third
customers
option.
Don't care if you're making heaps of money or not. They just want the cheapest possible service.
Look at $1 bread, $1 milk, look at $7 chickens in the grocery market alone, right? So if your competitor is selling it cheaper than you are and you're selling the same thing, an airline seat is an airline seat is an airline seat, you've got to match them on price. The change, if there is one in the US, and these are US domestic airlines, mostly domestic airlines, we should say, is they've all merged. So there's now four big ones. They own shares in all four. Mm-hmm.
There's now less competition.
There's much less additional capacity being put on. What normally drives profits down is an airline says, I'm going to put another plane in the sky. I'm going to try and fill that one up.
Yep.
And so the competitor does the same thing. All of a sudden, there's four planes flying around, 25% full. Yep. They're all losing money.
Yep. Yep.
So there's fewer airlines, and they're all putting on much less capacity. They're all behaving much more rationally.
Okay.
And so the supposition is that four decent-sized, rational airlines all making money right now and selling at really cheap PEs.
Really cheap.
We talked about the PE ratio last week.
Yep.
Those selling at cheap PEs, they're worth a punt. If you're a value investor looking for a cheap deal, airlines at the moment are cheap. And if the future isn't as bad as the past, then maybe there's some money to be made.
Mm. Yeah, and you've also seen fuel prices come way down as well, which is a nice thing as well for them. And I don't get all of that. I think that makes a bit of sense. The trouble is that as those factors have changed, they're very easily changed again in the future. I don't think there's anything permanent or structural about any of those changes where, you know, a far-sighted investor could sort of say in 5 years' time, they're still super rational, their costs are still very, very low.
Yep.
It could change, and it could change very, very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the real challenge is, look, they can sell the shares whenever they want, and they may well do that. But these guys are long-term investors. They're kind of planning to be in this for the long haul. So you've got to assume they've taken some sort of five-year-plus perspective and said, we think airlines are making a lot more money in 5 years than they are today.
Yeah.
I think that's an incredibly gutsy call. Neither you nor I, Andrew, are buying Qantas or Virgin shares anytime soon.
No, thanks.
One of the dangerous things, by the way, in investing is to say, Warren Buffett's wrong because.
I know,
almost
I know.
Always, whenever you say that, you're the one who ends up being wrong.
It's a brave person that says it, right?
Brave slash stupid. But.
No, that's what we're saying.
We're going to stay well and truly away from airlines. The share prices are higher. Qantas delivered a record profit last year.
Yeah.
Low fuel prices, high airfare prices. Airfare's already coming down. Oil's already going back up. Maybe the US market is different. Maybe there's something we don't know. Mm. But I reckon you'd be a bit of a mug to jump into airline shares right now.
All right.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au
Triple M.
Well, let's go to the foolish mailbag. And we had a listener write in, and he said, can you guys talk a bit about futures and bonds? So we tend to focus pretty heavily on shares here, but there's other things you can invest your money in. So,
bond, James. No, different bond. Different bond.
Bond's
the undies.
No, not the undies.
Okay.
No. It's far more boring than that, Scott. It is far more boring.
I'm glad we're
that.
Talking about it then.
Yes.
Our listeners will be stoked.
Tell me what a bond is.
A bond. Not the James Bond. All right, the other one. Okay. Look, a bond, think about a bond. Okay. There's no direct analogy. The easiest one is simply a term deposit. You can deposit your cash with somebody, that's normally a government or a company, for an agreed rate of interest. So you can buy Australian government bonds, 10-year bonds, for example, that will pay you 2% a year for the next 10 years.
And then pay your money back.
And then
back
in 10 years, you get that money back.
It's an IOU.
You can buy a corporate bond. There aren't many in Australia, to be fair.
No.
But you can buy a corporate bond, which is the same thing. Basically, you're subscribing to a Woolworths bond, for example, or a National Australia Bank bond, if they existed. They don't, but if they did. Mm-hmm. And you can basically give a company your money, and they'll pay you back interest, and then give you your money back at the end of the term.
Yeah, traditionally seen as very low-risk investments, right?
Lower risk. There's a whole lot. Bonds go everything from government bonds, which are super low risk.
US Treasuries, Australian bonds
are as low as the risk comes. Yeah. In fact, those bonds are used as the basis for all of their investment calculations. They're so low.
Yep.
It's considered the risk-free rate for those who've heard that term.
Yep.
But you can get company bonds from safe companies like, say, a Woolworths or a Telstra.
Yep. You can get bonds from Venezuela and Nigeria as well.
And you can get what they call junk bonds, right? So that's exactly right. Yeah. You can companies will issue debt at 10 or 12 or 15%.
Mm.
And if you want to take that bet, you might get 10 or 15% back, which sounds good, but the company might go broke and you might not get your money back.
Yeah.
So there's no point in getting 15% $100 today and losing the $100 tomorrow. You're only getting $15.
Which happens.
It does. And that's why they're called junk bonds, because the industry likes to call them high yield bonds because it sounds more attractive, right? But they're junk bonds.
Junk bonds doesn't sound
so
great.
Let's be really clear and call a spade a bloody shovel.
Okay.
So that's what a bond is.
Yes.
Okay.
And
over time, they tend to move in the opposite direction to shares, more or less. And they also tend to be something of an interest rate. If not hedge, at least they fluctuate with interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so the higher the interest rate over time, the higher the official cash rate goes up, the RBA's rate, the less those bonds are worth. Over the last 10 years, bonds have been a pretty good place to be, quite frankly, because interest rates have fallen. So if you got 5%, 6%, 7% 5 years ago in a 10-year bond, the equivalent right now is you're getting 2% in the bank or 1% in the bank or that 4 or 5 or 6% from those companies or from those governments. And so if they're paying back, if they're credit worthy, the value of those bonds is worth far, far more than what you get in a term deposit today.
Yeah.
And the price has shot through the roof.
Mm.
The problem is, as we talked about earlier in the episode, and it's a great question that we had from Joe who sent us the email, the message on Twitter, is, you know, is now the time for bonds? And the answer is a categorical no in our view, because you're now in a situation where interest rates are starting to turn. And so those bonds that are worth a lot in a falling rate environment are worth a heap less in a rising rate environment. That's where the prices of those bonds start to get squashed.
I get that if I'm buying a bond and then looking to sell it before it hits maturity. But if I'm buying this thing with the express purpose, it's a 5-year bond and I'm going to buy it today and I'm just going to keep holding it for that 5 years and I'm just going to get my money back. I'm not going to sell this thing. I'm not going to try and profit on that front. Is that not a reasonable proposition for someone who's just looking to have their capital protected and get a bit of an income stream along the way?
Yes, it is reasonable as long as you're getting the price that you want. No one's offering you 5 or 6% now.
Mm.
And so the challenge is you're only going to get someone issuing a bond at the prevailing interest rate plus or minus a couple of percentage points.
Yep,
so if the official rate's 4%, you might get a 6% bond. That's great. If you bought it 7, 8 years ago, you're still doing pretty well.
Yep.
But those bonds are worth less if you try and sell them in the market today. And quite frankly, you can get more in shares or other things right now. So they're less attractive in comparison to other assets that are available and are out there to be invested in. So they're not the worst thing in the world, but if you're looking for the highest possible return, you don't want to be in bonds.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's an unbroken law of finance and economics. There is a trade-off with everything. And the trade-off here is, yes, ostensibly these things are much lower risk, but the price you pay for that much lower risk is a much lower return. And that's the thing to bear in mind. So be aware of that trade-off.
Yeah, a term deposit, you would absolutely get your money back and you'll earn 3% a year.
Yep.
Or you buy shares, the average return is 10%, but every now and again, the shares go down. And every now and again, even more rarely, a company or two will go broke. And so that's why diversification is important. That's why risk management is important. That's why building a portfolio of quality businesses is important.
Mm.
But you can get more return in shares by taking a little bit more risk. As long as you manage that risk properly, there are plenty of people, to your point, Andrew, who will happily sleep at night saying, Give me my 2% in term deposits. Give me my 4% in bonds.
Yep.
I'll take it because at least I know that's as bad as it's going to get.
Yep.
As long as the company stays solvent, as long as the country stays solvent.
Okay, Scott, so we said we're going to talk about futures.
We did.
But we're out of time there, unfortunately. We will talk about futures in the future. and I look forward to that.
Me too.
So, but that does wrap it up. Thanks for your time today, Scott.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you for listening, Pools.
Don't forget, you can subscribe to Triple M's Motley Fool Money through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And of course, at triplem.com.au/podcast. And while you're doing that, please give us a 5-star rating. We'd really appreciate it. That's it. Until next time, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.